Good afternoon. Please be seated. We have only one case on our 3 o'clock docket, a reset from our ice day, so we were very lucky to have 70-degree weather today as opposed to 20-degree weather like we had before. If the clerk will please announce counsel. Ms. Pritchard.
Thank you.
There are two issues before the court today. The first issue is whether there was an improper hearing of this entire case based on jurisdiction issues at the district court level, since Ms. Arnold was a resident of California, the child born in the marriage had a home state that was not Texas. It is true that if you look at the brief that we prepared, my esteemed opposing counsel pointed out that we misstated the standard of review. Of course, this is de novo. When you're editing, you sometimes miss your boxes that you're checking. Our argument about jurisdiction has been and continues to be that Ms. Arnold was never a resident of Texas. We feel strongly that, in fact, there was no marriage community in Texas. We understand that there's an argument to be made to the other side, ably made. We also understand that because Mr. Price is in the military, he gets to elect to file his divorce here in Texas. However, the only thing that was to be divided in this particular short-term marriage was custody, possession, and access of a child. That's it. If you look at the record, you'll see that in the divorce decree, there are very standard general statements made as to division of property, because these two really didn't have any property. There was no real property. They had both had their own belongings for the duration of the marriage. The only thing we had to determine was what was going to happen with this child. This child was not born at the time the divorce was filed. This child wasn't born for several months, 4 to 5 months after the divorce was filed. No substantive hearings were held regarding the divorce or the child until that child was about 2 to 3 months old. Subsequently, the first hearing regarding the possession and access of this child was held when this child was about 4 to 5 months old.
But don't we look at the circumstances at the time of filing the plaintiff's original petition?
Yes, we do. We do. Perhaps Ms. Arnold got bad advice. She should have probably filed a divorce in California, if not before the divorce here was filed, and certainly shortly thereafter. However, there could have been an agreement as to which state could have and should have seen this divorce, and I believe some discussion ensued. She also filed an objection at the time she filed her answer, at the time she filed her counter petition. No hearing was ever held regarding that objection to the jurisdiction. After conversation with Ms. Arnold and all the notes in the file, it appears that she was told, or her counsel was told, to drop any suit that she had already filed in California or was intending to file.
So she's never filed a suit in California?
I believe she had attempted to file a suit in California or had begun the proceedings upon advice of counsel here.
So what would happen if we dismissed because of no jurisdiction over the subject matter of the child?
That's a good question. She's asked that question of me, and I'm frankly not sure. There is a child who is now living in Pennsylvania primarily with her father and has lived there for some time. My client would love to say that if this was dismissed because of no subject matter jurisdiction, that then she could just go pick up the child. She's been advised otherwise. Obviously, she would need to file something in California that would establish that she would be the proper parent to have that child, and I'm sure Mr. Price would file something here. So there'd be another difficult argument.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. This statute that we're dealing with, that we would like to deal with, of course, is not the statute that esteemed opposing counsel would like to deal with. We'd like to argue under the UCCJEA that there is a home state other than Texas regarding this child. clearly, that's something a little bit beyond the initial jurisdiction argument. However, because there's no other issues that were really truly to be determined in this divorce than the custody, possession, and access of this child, isn't it fair to argue the UCCJEA? Isn't it fair to argue about home state? Isn't it fair to say this is a child who lived for nearly 2 years in California before a district court decided that she was going to move to another state? Even if it was Texas she was going to move to, that's a difficult outcome in this particular case. Not insurmountable, but certainly something that we think should be considered. She did file an objection to this jurisdiction. She was told that she should acquiesce to this jurisdiction after no official hearing. She did continue to object to the jurisdiction all the way through to the trial. The only thing that was seriously, well, the only thing that's in the record for the trial is argument and evidence about custody, possession, and access. There were no property arguments made at trial because there was an agreement as to property division. There was no significant property.
Does she now concede their personal jurisdiction over herself? Is that what I understand you to be saying at the beginning, as opposed to subject matter jurisdiction over the child?
I don't believe she's ever conceded personal jurisdiction. I think that she still believes that her divorce should have happened in California and should still happen in California. I believe we had a very naive respondent. I believe that even though counsel here advised her that she, trial counsel, advised her that she should file something in California, once she had an experience where she was led to believe that, well, you should cancel whatever you're doing in California, then she acquiesced. But she's never conceded personal jurisdiction. She still believes this should have happened in California. Okay. I'd like to move at this time into my argument about the second issue. Did the trial court abuse its discretion in allowing the testimony of an expert when that expert did not use a methodology that met the standards of Dobear, Robinson, and Gamel? We believe that she absolutely was damaged by the expert testimony of Dr. Clayton. There was a Dobear challenge before Dr. Clayton made her argument or presented her evidence to the trial court. She was presented as an expert. Ms. Arnold lost that challenge because she absolutely meets the criteria of an expert. Absolutely meets the criteria. She's not only qualified by her education, qualified by her experience, she has testified in dozens of cases in this county, in this district, most of them criminal, as well as commitment hearings. But she has testified. She's testified in family law cases, certainly. However, there are guidelines that guide her testimony. Her own guidelines, which she testified in both the Dobear challenge hearing as well as her testimony leading up to, before the jury, leading up to her actual testimony and questioning, she testified that she follows guidelines of her own profession, the AAPL guidelines. She violated them in this respect. Yes, there's conversation within the guidelines that say that a forensic psychiatrist should interview a subject before they offer opinion or their analysis or their diagnosis about the subject. It also certainly states that if that's not permissible or available, then they should use collateral information for that. They should use collateral data. It also says in those guidelines, however, that in the case of a child custody matter, they should always interview the parents because of the nature of that kind of proceeding. She did not do it. Now, you're going to hear that she didn't have to, that that's a guideline, that that's absolutely certainly something that she should do, but she couldn't do. We would argue that's absolutely not true. Ms. Arnold appeared here six times for hearings from California to Texas. Mr. Price was here for 14 hearings. Neither of them lived in this state, but both of them managed to present themselves and the child for a social study by a social worker who was here in Tarrant County. Because they were ordered to submit to that, they were ordered to pay the travel expenses, they were ordered to take care of those necessities. I find it hard to believe that had they been ordered to submit, or even by agreement had submitted to Dr. Clayton, that they wouldn't have done it. I know my client would have done it.
So there was no discovery motion to seek an interview of the appellant?
Not to my knowledge. And I've asked everyone involved, were you ever asked to present yourself to Dr. Clayton? I know she would have done this because in every instance that she was asked to do something in this case, she showed up and did it. She has visited with her child every opportunity that she's given since this proceeding. This is not a mom who just hangs out and can't be here. She's not here today because this is a very short proceeding and it's all a lot of legal argument. And it's a long distance from California to here. The strongest cases that support our position, of course, are Gamble versus Jack Williams Chevrolet. I'm not going to read you the law. You certainly are aware of the law. And basically, what she's supposed to do, what Dr. Clayton is supposed to do, or what the court is supposed to do, is to weigh and determine whether her testimony is of probative value. Is it reliable? It's not reliable if she hasn't gone through every avenue in this particular case to gather all the evidence she could. She testified that she saw Ms. Arnold testify in court. Okay. She saw that in a contained environment. She saw questions that she was asked that she probably knew the general gist of the questions that would be coming. She saw her cross-examined. She saw how she handled cross-examination. She did not get her own opportunity to observe Ms. Arnold with her child, nor did she take that opportunity, nor did she have the opportunity herself to discuss with Ms. Arnold Ms. Arnold's ideas and perceptions and concerns about raising this child. She testified, ultimately, that, well, Ms. Arnold has a mental illness. Okay. What she didn't testify to is how well will she parent this child, or how well do you predict she can parent this child? I'm not sure how she could have testified to that without interviewing Ms. Arnold or observing her at the very least with this child, without interviewing Mr. Price.
Matters just for cross-examination?
And that she was cross-examined about that. She was cross-examined about whether she'd interviewed. And of course, the jury was told she has not interviewed this child. That's also part of the guideline. That's part of the things that she has to talk about, is whether she's interviewed Ms. Arnold. The problem here is we had a jury. We didn't have a judge who could, in their experience, certainly in this particular judge's experience, weigh the fact that, okay, here's what she's saying this woman has. I've seen lots and lots of folks at my bench who may have been diagnosed with a serious mental illness and yet managed to have possession and access of their children. We had a jury who were lay people. They were told this is an expert. She said she won't be able to parent her child effectively. That's what we're trying to guard in this state, is the sanctity of the jury, the sanctity of the rights of plaintiffs and respondents to have a jury that's unbiased, to have a jury that sees the proper evidence, and there was certainly lots of other evidence available where they could have made the decision. Sure, she should be a conservator. She should have maybe joint managing conservatorship, but we might limit her access and possession. There were plenty of other people to give her that evidence, to give the jury that evidence. But we presented Dr. Clayton first as an expert. She must be the final word to the layperson. That's our issue. That's our concern. Had she interviewed Gina Arnold, we wouldn't have had a reason to be here, frankly. Thank you. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Pritchard.
May it please the court. It's the appellee Matthew Price's position, of course, that the trial court did correctly exercise both personal and subject matter jurisdiction over the parties and the suit affecting the parent-child relationship here. And it's also Mr. Price's position that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in allowing the expert witness testimony of Dr. Clayton. We've already talked about the standard of review issue, as I know the court was aware of that anyway. And it seems to me as though appellant has also acknowledged Mr. Price's ability to file in Tarrant County, even though he was stationed in Pennsylvania. It sounds like those issues have been resolved as well. I won't spend too much time on the supporting authority for that unless the court has questions or would like for me to. I would like to talk a little bit more about Ms. Arnold's residence or lack thereof outside of the marital residence in Texas at the time the divorce was filed. In fact, at the time that the divorce was filed, Ms. Arnold didn't really have a residence outside of the residence that they'd set up in Tarrant County. And even though she wasn't here 100% of the time, they did have extended visits together here in Tarrant County. As you know from the briefing, they were setting up a home here, you know, setting up phone accounts together. They engaged in sexual intercourse here in Tarrant County, which we find out later resulted in the birth of their child. That was from that March 07 visit. Planning a wedding reception in Tarrant County. You know, she'd actually entered into a contract for the sale of a home in Tarrant County. I mean, this was obviously the intended marital residence, albeit a short one, for this couple. And to say that her residence was established in California at the time the divorce was filed doesn't seem accurate when we consider the fact that Ms. Arnold was actually incarcerated in Nevada at the time she found out she was pregnant. And so that's after the divorce has been filed. And then she also spent some time at her parents' home in California after she was released. And then we also know that she signed a lease with Mr. Price in Pennsylvania. So really outside of what they had established in Texas, there wasn't too much of a residence elsewhere. When we talk about personal jurisdiction, Ms. Arnold clearly waived her objection to personal jurisdiction by not filing a special appearance. That's the procedure she should have engaged in if she wanted to object to the court's personal jurisdiction over her, and she didn't do it. I know that she did raise this objection to jurisdiction in her pleading. However, you know, it wasn't couched as a special appearance, and then she went on to seek affirmative relief from the court without having the court rule on this personal jurisdiction matter. She filed her own counterpetition for divorce, asking the court to do the exact same things that Mr. Price was asking the court to do. And honestly, even if she had properly raised in a special appearance her personal jurisdiction objection, the trial court would have been correct in overruling it. You know, we looked at the marital residence. That was clearly established here in Texas. This divorce was filed within 2 years prior to the marital residence ending, so it meets that jurisdictional requirement under Texas Family Code 6.305, or when there's been any consistent contacts, minimum and purposeful contacts with the state. Well, Ms. Arnold had plenty of minimum and purposeful contacts with the state, just like we already talked about. The extended visits to the marital residence, engaging in the intercourse that resulted in the birth of the party's child, setting up this home together, accounts together, the wedding reception, all of those same things were present here. And then Section 102.011 of the Family Code goes on to provide additional support for the court exercising personal jurisdiction over Ms. Arnold if she entered a general appearance or filed any responsive document having the effect of waiving her contest of personal jurisdiction. That's also present here. Again, she did not file a special appearance, and she did, in fact, go ahead and file her own affirmative plea for relief in the form of a counterpetition. So when we talk about where the residence was established, you know, we need to consider all of those facts and truly look to the marital residence in Tarrant County as her residence at the time this divorce was filed. With respect to subject matter jurisdiction, just as the court accurately pointed out, jurisdiction is determined based on the circumstances that exist at the date the suit was filed. And when Mr. Price filed for divorce, there was no child born of the marriage. Jurisdiction was proper over both the dissolution of the marriage and the suit affecting the parent-child relationship for all those reasons that we just talked about, those minimum and purposeful contacts, the fact that the residence was here. And as you've heard from opposing counsel, Ms. Arnold does contend that the UCC-JEA, as it's codified in the Texas Family Code, is the governing statute here for determining subject matter jurisdiction. The fatal flaw in that argument is that the UCC-JEA does not apply to an unborn child. At the time this divorce was filed, there was no child born of the marriage. And at no time, including after the time that the child was born, did Ms. Arnold initiate proceedings anywhere else, including California. So there never was a jurisdictional argument to be resolved. Another distinction I'd like to point out to the court is the authority cited by appellant in support of the UCC-JEA applying for the subject matter jurisdiction determination. They're so distinguishable from our facts here because they each involved a simultaneous proceeding in another jurisdiction. Those steps were never taken here. The vast majority of those cases involved children that were already born at the time that the divorce was filed as well, or the suit affecting parent-child relationship was filed. So to allow the appellant to sort of seek protection in our Texas UCC-JEA, when she didn't even really have an established residence under than the Texas marital residence, I think it would actually undermine the intent behind the statute that's sort of to prevent this hopping around jurisdictions in order to get a subject matter jurisdiction determination made apart from where the parties resided, the child's contacts are, and where the evidence is. And that was the path that they were on here in Texas prior to her incarceration in Nevada and Mr. Price filing for divorce. So for those reasons, Mr. Price would ask that the court affirm the trial court's rulings on the personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction issues. With respect to the expert witness testimony, again, appellant has pointed out that yes, you know, there is an exception to the guideline that the witness be interviewed. And I think that's really important here because it wasn't as if Dr. Clayton just ignored that guideline, just decided that it wasn't going to be important here and she could just indicate to the jury that she'd had collateral data through depositions, hearing, trial testimony. She actually said, and this is included in Mr. Price's brief, you know, that in diagnosing this particular antisocial personality disorder, that diagnostic interview is not even as relevant as the collateral information because usually this person is deceitful or charming and manipulative and able to weave an entirely different story than what the actual records show. And that's what Dr. Clayton felt was appropriate here based on the DSM-4-TR, the diagnostic method that she used in diagnosing.
That sounds like she's prejudging her as having an antisocial personality, though, before she, as the reason for not.
Right, I think it was... I think it was, we've reviewed this collateral data, and this is sufficient. We've seen, you know, her admissions of lying, her admissions of stealing. That was throughout. And so in the context of that and the testimony that Dr. Clayton was going to provide, it wasn't going to add anything to her ability to diagnose if she had the face-to-face interview. She thought it was appropriate here.
Did Ms. Arnold produce any expert witnesses?
No, that's the other thing. Justice Walker pointed out, yes, these are matters for cross-examination, and in addition to that, she didn't put on any controverting evidence through her own expert witness. And, she certainly would have had the opportunity to do so. And, you know, this DSM-4-TR, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is the basis for Dr. Clayton's methodology, it was examined at length during the Daubert hearing. I mean, Dr. Clayton was able to testify about the testing and retesting of this methodology. She was able to talk about how commonly accepted it is in her forensic psychiatry community. You know, the minimum, just the complete de minimis rate of error, less than 1%. And like you said, no controverting testimony was put on. But now on appeal, Ms. Arnold claims that this expert testimony was irrelevant to the issue of conservatorship and didn't assist the jury in making its determination. But Dr. Clayton actually testified about some pretty severe effects that a parent with this disorder can have on their children, you know, effects such as leaving their children unattended or without proper supervision, maybe squandering money that would be needed for household necessities, even just kind of becoming disinterested in the children when something kind of more appealing comes along for that person, such as a new relationship. And so it's illogical to say that these effects aren't relevant to a conservatorship determination when the court's considering what's in the best interest of this child. Dr. Clayton's testimony included statements that these parents can even be a danger to their children, and that the children themselves can pick up on some of these behaviors, such as lying and manipulating. This is not testimony that a lay witness could have offered. It certainly assisted the jury in making its conservatorship determination. So, you know, the trial court's conclusion that the testimony was not only relevant, but that it was compliant with Daubert factors, it assisted the jury in making its determination, this testimony was reliable, those decisions by the court were not an abuse of the court's discretion. And we'd ask that this court affirm the trial court's determination to admit that evidence.
Do you happen to recall when the Daubert hearing was held? Was it immediately before the final trial, or was it a month before?
It was, I believe it was during. Other questions?
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lackey. Ms. Pritchard, rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
I would address Appellee's assertion that Ms. Arnold could have and would have provided an expert. Certainly she could have. Our problem here is we had a mother of a young child who was living in California. She was already incurring massive costs to get here to Texas for repeated hearings shortly within months after the child's birth. She brought the child with her every single time, so at some point they quit allowing her to travel free with that child. She did submit to the cost of a social study. She paid for the social worker to come out to California. She submitted to that process believing that that was necessary and helpful to determine what was in the best interest of her child. If anyone had said to her, oh, well, you're going to have to go and take out a loan and get yet another expert to talk about whether you are deficient or sufficient to parent your child, then perhaps she should have done that. However, are we therefore saying that in the case of any mental illness or any kind of personality defect or disorder, that then you must go and get your own expert that's going to say, oh, well, she may be bipolar, but she's not Charlie Sheen-level bipolar. She's not going to leave her children alone with no supervision. That's a little bit overreaching, I believe. She did have a social worker who made a complete and thorough report regarding the interaction of the parents with the children, regarding the interaction of the parents with each other. And then at trial, we had Dr. Clayton. I believe after discussion with trial counsel and Ms. Arnold that I was advised that they weren't really aware that she would definitely be testifying at trial and to the subject matter of her testimony. Again, absolutely, it's a cross-examination issue. You get faced with an expert you didn't expect. They did exactly like they were supposed to. They had the Daubert Challenge hearing. They lost it. They had to go in and do the testimony and do the cross-examination. They cross-examined her about what specifics do you believe this woman has or will do to damage this child. There was no evidence put on that she'd ever put this child in any risk. There was no evidence put on that she had harmed this child in any way. There was no evidence that she'd ever left this child alone. And yet, Dr. Clayton, the expert, told the jury, well, she will do these things. Seems to me that amounts to speculation. She was speculating that a person with this disorder could leave their child alone. Absolutely. A person without that disorder could leave their child alone. A person with this disorder could use all the grocery money on some frivolous oddity. Absolutely they could. So could a person without that disorder. The bottom line is, they told the jury right up front, early in the case, she's a problem. She has this antisocial behavior disorder. I don't even need to interview her to find out if that's what she's got, and she's going to be bad for this child. We think that you should reverse this and give her another shot. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pritchard. Thank you, Ms. Lackey. Your arguments were appreciated today. We thank you for your briefing as well, and your case is now submitted, and you are excused.